Hello and welcome to Platforms and Pitfalls. I'm Rowan.
And I'm Blue.
And we're here to talk about game design. Continuing our dominant strategy mitigation series, we're going to look at consistency and mitigating consistent strategies and approaches, often done through randomness.
There's going to be things that immediately stand out as powerful or good or easy to the player. And one of the ways you can stop the player from just relying on that is just making it not consistent, not something they can rely on.
And our first game uses perhaps one of the most classical forms of consistency mitigation, a deck.
Magic the Gathering is a popular trading card game designed by Richard Garfield and published by Wizards of the Coast since all the way back in 1993. It would be the example for a lot of people when it comes to consistency mitigation. It is something that is a bit different from stuff that we've talked about before. I mean, we've broken video games as a rule before, but Magic the Gathering is very much a, you know, physical-based entity, despite many forays and attempts into the digital space. There are a lot of formats in Magic that basically deal with changing how consistent you can get the big powerhouse cards. So in the initial example that we thought of immediately was just Magic as a limited format, where you have the drafting formats, have a number of packs that you open, and then you do a draft, and you effectively have to just make do with the cards that you are able to get out of those packs. You have to build a deck that is of a minimum 40 cards, and you cannot have more than 4 cards of any one name unless, you know, it's land or there are specific rules around
it. I want to just, in talking about limited, like there are two main limited formats. We have sealed, which is you get lots of packs, and there's draft, which is the specific, you take one card from a booster and pass it round. And these are very different in how they do consistency mitigation, because in a purely random collection of cards, you can't plan around what you're going to build, and you have to build something that's generally going to be more varied. Whereas once you are able to pick out cards from boosters, there's likely going to be a lot more consistency in how your deck's going to operate. And it's going to be closer to a constructed deck that isn't part of these limited formats compared to a sealed deck.
There's a lot of base covering that we need to do to be able to talk about Magic, but I guess here we're just assuming that you know that Magic is a 5-color game, you know that it has lands as a system, and like we don't have to talk about that, right?
I don't think so. I think that is a dangerous assumption to make, but we kind of have to.
Yeah. So if you don't know what those things are, this might go a bit over your head, but hopefully you'll still catch the gist of it. With the draft, you can create a monocolor deck, depending on what set you're drafting from. It's very possible. In sealed, I don't think that's almost ever an option, is there?
It's almost not ever an option. In some formats, historically, you've been able to make like weird semi-monocolored decks, like in...
If it has artifacts and...
If it has artifacts and if it has hybrid mana stuff, like you could make a 5-color deck, but it's only using white mana. Like, that would be a thing you could do because Magic has lots of things. But in most formats, that's not possible. In most formats, you'd be playing 2 colors with a splash of a third. Would be how I characterize most sealed decks.
And you're absolutely right. Those are two completely different feeling limited formats. There's not really much to say about which is better. Neither is better than the other. They just provide very different feelings.
One is definitely more rewarding of knowledge of a set. You have to know in a draft what you might be able to build to make good choices about what to pick, because you have to know what you might find. In a sealed format, you just have a bunch of options and you have to decide what's going to happen with the whole thing. And there are really interesting differences here, because in draft, when you get a booster, obviously the first booster you open, you've got the rare card in it, which most people would take initially. And every subsequent one, you're going to go down in rarity generally pretty quickly. And that does change up things, like how much you think, oh, will I be able to get the good thing of this rarity now, or should I just get this better common immediately? Mm-hmm. Those are kind of interesting questions to ask. that Sealed doesn't. I'm not as much of a fan of Draft, to be honest. I don't like learning full sets in advance, but that's more that I'm a lazy person as opposed to a flaw with the format.
I've paid some attention to Draft, and I will say that the hallmark of a good Draft player is being able to go, this rare, not worth it. Not even worth looking at. None of these uncommons are worth looking at. It's all about the commons. Or, wow, this rare is really cool and it would be a really cool build around, but I need consistency, so I'm going to go for this common instead because it's going to give me what I need. I have seen those discussions before and they're fascinating because card rarity is a very loose shorthand for power, and you do want power. You do want power spikes in these limited formats, but consistency tends to win you more games in the long run.
And limited formats are very interesting in that they're very different to constructed because of the limited availability of various tools. Mm-hmm. So cards that are very good in constructed can be very bad in limited formats, potentially.
If you don't have synergy, you can't rely on that happening.
And so yeah, limited formats are quite different in to constructed formats because that consistency is very different in a game that is already defined to a great extent by its relationship to consistency. Because in Magic, you just don't have the options that you want. And a lot of dominant play in this game's history is about things that allow you to really just defeat that and just get exactly what you want whenever you need it. This is why tutors have historically, very cheap tutors have been very powerful cards for a lot of the history of this game.
I suppose we can talk very quickly about that. The tutors were a set of cards that Magic printed relatively early in the life cycle that were able to look for specific things in your deck and either place them in your hand or on top of your deck to guarantee them a very short time frame.
And tutoring has become a verb in Magic, where any card that lets you search for a specific thing is generally called a tutor unless it searches for a land.
Tutor has actually bled out into other card games that I've played as well. It's not just a Magic term anymore.
And that's the case with a lot of Magic terms. A lot of people use Magic as the universal language of card games, which is a very interesting but incredibly different discussion.
Definitely, definitely. Another huge aspect to the consistency is the four-card cap. Oftentimes, at common rarity, you will get very powerful or very cost-effective creatures, perhaps. You know, something that's just really good to have a bunch of. So getting up to four of them is not anywhere near impossible, in Draft especially. Sealed a bit more inconsistent. Which means that making it so that you can only have four of any particular card does matter, because in your opening hand, you draw seven cards, and then you can take a mulligan, which effectively means that if your hand isn't looking good, you can try again, but you end up with less cards. There are a couple of different ways to mulligan, but let's just say that at the end of the day, you'll have six cards in hand, and then five cards in hand, and then four, and so on. Which means that you get to look at 7 to 13 out of your 40-card deck relatively consistently for your opening hand to get the card that you want.
And in a 40-card deck, having the chance of getting one of a card that you have four of is pretty high within the first three turns of the game, because you'd be looking at about a quarter of your deck within that time frame. Four cards in a 40-card deck, the odds are pretty good in that sense. It's worth saying that in constructed play, which is how Magic is often played, decks are usually 60 cards with four of a kind, 60 at a minimum. Usually you would play it that 60, but it is a minimum technically. And historically though, Magic decks were originally 40 cards with no restrictions on the amounts of any cards. And I think this is a very interesting difference in early Magic. Early Magic's a very bizarre phenomena in general, but it is interesting that this restriction of cards was not an original factor in the game, which I think was partially because it wasn't expected to be taken very seriously, and thus when you see players taking games seriously, they'll push things to their limits, and you had decks that were fairly boring, all burn spells and all mountains basically kind of things, which would kill really quickly and efficiently.
Still does.
You now have to be more creative about how you get just a hand of burn spells, though. They can't just all be lightning bolts.
Yeah. That's true, but sometimes a set or a block has effectively four varieties of lightning bolt and just put card draw in the middle. I will give particular credit to anyone who's ever designed for Magic the Gathering, not just Richard Garfield, but the amazing team of designers that has followed since. All of these small rule adjustments and changes have over the years created what Magic is today. And it's really the combination of foresight of being able to say, maybe 40 is too consistent. Maybe we go up to 60. That feels better. And, you know, then working from there and all of that. That is amazing. It is one of the most beautiful mathematical games ever. Some very smart people have done the math and statistically shown that a 60 versus 61 card deck is X amount more consistent, and therefore in 99%, 99 point something percent of the cases, better of a deck option than 61, 62, etc. I will say that I don't think that that is true as much as people think it is. This is just a gut instinct. I think there can be situations where a 61/62 card deck will be more consistent because we're coming into an era where we're breaking more of the rules of Magic. We shied away from tutoring. Tutors are either expensive or, you know, not as common anymore, but we have a lot more mana cheats at the moment. And I think that there's something that can be done with a couple more cards in your deck to, in the end, balance it out.
For sure. And even then, you're still rolling a lot of dice. Like 60 cards, 61 cards, like you're not going to get necessarily a card that's four of a kind in every match, which is the main sort of argument for a 60 card deck over a smaller one of this sort of size.
And for anyone who's not versed in Magic, that is the issue of 60 versus 61 cards is a hugely contentious issue-ish. As in, people feel very, very strongly that 60 is the optimum, and that there is no world where you should ever even consider going to 61. Which, to me, I feel like that's a bit of a waste of design space, personally. And as a player, I really just want to challenge that sometimes.
And there are a lot of players who do challenge that, although they go a little bit beyond 60. They go to 100, exactly, with no variation whatsoever. And it's the format of Commander, which has a really interesting relationship with consistency, in that you have 99 cards, all non-land cards have to be different.
Non-basic land cards, sorry.
But you have a Commander, which is a legendary creature that represents your deck as like the leader of the deck. And they are effectively always in your hand for the purpose of the mechanics. Which means you have a deck that is simultaneously very inconsistent because you have a lot of very different cards in the deck. But you also have one part that is more consistent than anything in Magic can ever be. And this combination of factors really changes how the game feels, because you often have the Commander being a combo piece that works with most things in the deck. So exactly how your Commander is going to interact with the game in any given match might vary, but everything is planned to work around that Commander kind of thing. Well, not always, because people use Commanders in lots of different ways, and sometimes they use them for not necessarily that kind of thing, but Commander, yeah, it interacts with consistency in a very different way, is what I'm getting at.
It absolutely does, yes.
I think that's all we've got to say for Magic. So we're going to move back to the digital realm and look at a roguelike, which is built all around randomness. Mystery Dungeon, Shirin the Wanderer. This is the first in the Shirin sub-series of the prolific Mystery Dungeon franchise. We're looking specifically at the 2006 DS port of the 1995 Super Famicom original, developed by Chunsoft, directed by Tadashi Fukuzawa and Hironori Ishigami, who led the DS version specifically. The Mystery Dungeon series is often considered the Japanese baseline for the roguelike genre, and often comparable to NetHack in terms of mindshare and such. If you know this series, you probably know it for the Pokemon Mystery Dungeon games, which definitely mechanically share some things in common, but Shirin is interesting specifically because of the emphasis it places on improvisation through items. Character is very minimal in terms of importance. Shirin himself has very few tools at his disposal. He can punch things and throw arrows, and that's basically it. Oh, and throw items, of course.
He does throw arrows. He doesn't get a bow. Yeah, he does throw arrows, yeah.
He just throws arrows. He doesn't have a bow. So it's fairly limited roguelike in that sense, which is one of the appeals to Shiren, in that a lot of roguelikes can get very complicated, especially in terms of how an individual character works. Shiren is entirely about improvising with what you find. You don't have a lot of experience with classic roguelikes, do you, Blue?
No, they are monolithic, very daunting games that demand you get very good at its core systems, not very quickly, but in order to make any kind of real progress. Yeah. And I'm not a bad gamer, but I also don't have the skill set for traditional roguelikes.
And definitely one of the boons of Shiren is it has a UI that's readable, which in the roguelike genre is not something that came up until about 2006 or so. Maybe even later. When did Dungeons & Dreadmore come out? That was when we got usable UIs in roguelikes.
Oh wow, that's really late. That poor genre.
It's not a genre that's easy to play for the most part, but the Mystery Dungeon series is one of the accessible points because it has a UI built for a console interface as opposed to a keyboard. So, in Shiren, your character's fairly limited. You have 3 equipment slots, a weapon, a shield, and an armband, which are pretty limited in how they work. Shields increase defense, weapons do damage, and armbands do effects. This might be increasing your throwing strength for when you throw items. This might be decreasing your movement but giving you defense. Any number of like things that would fall into like accessories in other games are what armbands are covering. So how each item you might pick up for your character is pretty clear in how they're going to impact them. Items might be cursed, which means you can't de-equip them, but that doesn't mean they're bad in other ways necessarily, just that you're stuck with one. And on the ground you find a lot of other items. You find scrolls, which cast magic, wands, which are reusable and cast magic, but to only limited time, jars you can store things in, and herbs and weeds, which are
rice balls.
Food.
Honestly, genuinely, my favorite part of the game was just the rice balls.
Rice balls specifically or food systems?
No, the rice balls. I don't know why, they just felt very right for the game. And then there's enemies that deal with rice balls specifically. Rice balls were a weird punishment in the game. There were enemies that turned things to weeds, which were completely useless, but there were also enemies that turned things to rice balls, which is like, at least it gives me food.
And so food's important. So Shiren operates on 2 clocks in the game. A lot of roguelikes have the food clock, which is a hunger meter that slowly decreases over time that you need to eat to fill up. And it also has the winds of something or other clock, which at a certain point, a gust of wind will just advance you to the next floor. These both exist primarily to prevent grinding and to make you think about resource spending. And in your many playthroughs, you may have noticed like some playthroughs you get lots of food and you can actually like eat fine and sensibly. But in some playthroughs, you might have to use like the monsters that turn things into rice balls, like hope that you can turn random swords in your inventory to rice balls or something. Enemies are really interesting in Shiren in that enemies' placements and spawnings are random, but each enemy acts really consistently and logically. So you can always deduce how things are going to function based on what enemies are on the field, but it's which enemies you're going to run into and what tools you have to deal with them that are the random parts. And I guess that's like my interesting thing about Shiren. All the individual parts of Shiren work fairly simply, logically, and consistently, but it's the combinations in which you have these things that are the interesting variations. Maybe you find a powerful monster early in the game and you have only like a few indirect ways to deal with it, so you try and avoid it. Maybe you have like a bunch of dragon herbs, which are basically fireballs that you can conjure, and they can deal massive amounts of damage to it but be really limited to the next big thing you fight and such.
One of the fun parts about Shiren is just learning what each enemy does, because you're right, and they act so differently, and I always enjoy that process in a video game of, oh, this does this, oh, this does this. Shiren feeds it to you quite, not slowly, but like in a very manageable pace. There's almost always something to think about, to look forward to try to learn, and at the same time, you are always relying on, yeah, last run I saw this guy, need to do this now, you know, things like that.
And you get a lot of interesting foreshadowing about like how interactions can work, because there are lots of NPCs in these dungeons. The narrative justification for what you're doing is you're climbing up this well-regarded mountain to try and get to the El Dorado and have a wish granted, basically. The place where wishes come true, meet the Phoenix, blah, blah, blah. And there are lots of people going on this adventure too. And as you climb up, you can talk with them, and they all have not exactly amazing advice to give, but everyone illustrates some kind of mechanic to you in some way. Whether it's like, here's this item you should be on the lookout for, here's this trap that you might not know how it functions and how to deal with it. But also, often, if there's a bad thing they talk about why it can be a good trick. Like I mentioned, cursed items, which you can't de-equip. But there are traps in the game that force you to unequip all the items that you have equipped. And the idea of those traps is that they waste your turns, because equipping takes up one turn. I guess I should say this, because in this day and age, it's not a given. This is one of the roguelikes where when you take a move, everything takes a move with you. It's not real time in that sense. Sorry, it's not real time in a traditional sense.
I wanted to bring this up before, but sometimes dealing with the enemies feels like playing Pac-Man in a turn-based game.
Yes, because you're trying to kite them to certain layouts so that you can deal with only one at a time and things like that.
And technically the ghosts have very specific AI and can be predicted, but you know, you don't have the time to in that game. But with Shirin, you know, imagine if Shirin was just real time. You'd just get surrounded and mobbed and died.
Yeah, you would. Like, Shirin asks you to deal with each encounter fairly carefully. You've got a lot of leeway for the first few floors, but if you're particularly dumb, even on the first floor, you can get mauled by the game's equivalent of slimes, the mammal. Shirin gives you a lot of different tools, but you don't know whether you're going to get any of them. And in limiting your character's main base of abilities, it is really pushing you to try different things, which a lot of games in general are bad at getting players to use consumables. I think Shirin does that pretty well. What was your experience with that? Did you feel like you used your consumables well?
First two runs, I did the, I'm going to save this. I'm going to need it at some point. I'm going to save this. And then you get to the point where you realize that somewhat nihilistically, none of this matters. This isn't going to be the run. This is more learning. So let's use things as we get them to try to make the most of them, to try to figure out when they're best. And you still end up with a huge stockpile of things, but I would start experimenting with, I wonder if increasing your max health does anything. So if you're eating food, but you're already at full hunger or are not hungry at all, you increase your maximum amount of hunger so you can go for longer without eating. It's not a lot, but you know, it was definitely something that I started thinking about. If a run is going to give me a lot of food, a lot of rice balls early, let's just try seeing how high I can get that number, whether or not that's going to make a difference in the playstyle eventually. Interestingly, not really. Like, as inconsistent as the items are, your core loop with Shirin is very similar most of the time. It's just which specific items you get to use.
Yes, it's very consistent in like what you're doing, but it's very disparate in how you solve a problem.
Yeah, I didn't get a lot of the like cool stuff because I'm just not good at this game, so I didn't get to push very far. I got up to maybe only like 8, like floor 8 or whatever.
Yeah, and at that point it feels fairly safe and tame, especially the DS version, which is a bit less swingy in its item generation. The Super Famicom version has less bounds on when items might spawn, whereas the DS version is very much like, you might get a really cool item early, but you probably won't until the later half of the game.
My experience was definitely that because those swingy items didn't exist too much, grinding for levels felt more consistent than relying on items at that early stage of
the game. Yeah, I guess the general sort of flow of the game is you spend a large part of the game building up an inventory, building up your items, and getting to like, no, okay, this is my Shirin. My Shirin has the hide shield, so he declines in food at half the rate, and he has a brace for a far sight so he can see all the enemies. That's my strategy. Now I know how to use my items. You obviously use some items before you get up to this point, but you're sort of preparing for the after that, which is like the second or third town, I think.
And honestly, that's why I died, because that's when the game ramps up its monster encounters as well. It's around then where you have to rely on the items, where you can't just brute force walk up to every monster and hit it. it just doesn't work anymore. And that's where I'm bad at the game. Like, so.
And it's a really hard roguelike. I've been playing this on and off for, I guess, 10 years-ish. And I still haven't ascended. I haven't gotten to the very top of the mountain. I've gotten pretty close once or twice. But in replaying for research for this episode, I did not get as far as I hoped up that mountain again. But yeah, so basically, it's a roguelike that encourages items and improvisation compared to many. And that's why I think Shirin's like an interesting one to look at. Looking onto a more long-form thing, though, we're going to look at a game that slowly removes options as you continue playing through it. Just a little post-production note. This particular section has been re-recorded and it had lots of issues with connections, so it's patched across multiple recording sessions and might sound a little bit weird and inconsistent, but we hope that it works for you. Enjoy the rest of the show. Lost Dimension is a 2014 tactical role-playing game by Lancast, the developers of the Etrian Odyssey series, among other games, designed by Takeshi Oga, Yu Yamashita, and Makoto Tsuchibayashi. This is a very interesting game in like when it was made. So the core conceit is that you are a group of 11 psychics climbing a tower to save the world, and there's a traitor in the group for every floor. And at the end of every floor, characters vote on someone to erase. This game came out in 2014, which is a very specific time. It was during this like rise of strategy RPGs in both Japan and the West through XCOM and Fire Emblem Awakening. And it also had this moment where we had things like Danganronpa that really popularized the narrative structure of the death game. A game where you have a bunch of characters in a small environment who, for some reason, have to eliminate each other to progress. And this game is really interesting in that it is both trying to put a death game narrative tropes into a role-playing game, but is also trying to put them into the game both narratively and mechanically. In any other game, you would have, in this sort of system, a list of these are the six traitors, and I will never ever use them because they will be out of my party eventually. In this game, though, after the first one, they're purely randomized, which leads to lots of interesting consequences to the systems and the narrative as well. But for the most part, we're going to focus on how this deals with common dominant strategies in role-playing games, being that in most role-playing games, you usually just stick to the same group of characters and only shift when you have to at a bare minimum.
So the main thing that immediately comes to my mind when you say that is, what if my healer dies?
And the game has a really good answer to this. So basically, whenever someone is erased in the game, you get materia, which is basically each skill tree that you had invested points into. Each character's 3 skill trees. So no matter what, you're always going to keep whatever skills you have invested in. But maybe another character isn't as well built to do those things, so the healer may die, and you can put it onto anyone else, his skill tree. But they might not have the MP to heal effectively or something. But you can still do it.
Also in the materia, the skills no longer progress. Correct?
That's right. Once a character's died, that skill tree can no longer be progressed. However, Lost Dimension's pretty fine in the sense that while leveling up skills is important and useful, often the first level of a skill is enough to do most of what you need it to do. Like, a level 10 skill is better than level 1 skill, but a level 3-4 skill will, like, be fine at end game, but maybe not ideal.
I guess I should note here that I have vastly less amount of time with this game as compared to you, Rowan.
I have a lot of time with this game. I played through it like 3 times, which is a lot to play through RPG. It's relatively short at about like 20-25 hours, which for this genre is pretty short and sweet. And the game does encourage you to play it through multiple times through various systems, but they're not terribly interesting. It's kind of a bad New Game Plus sort of experience. But the thing that's fun about that is that every time you play through, you get a wildly different party and party composition, which leads to you developing characters in different ways. What materia you have affects like how you're going to build out the rest of your characters through the end game and such. Even though the general strategy of the combat itself becomes fairly homogenous because I can't ever plan around what you might have.
Yeah, the game has to be designed around the idea that at any point in the game, you could not have anyone. They can't ever make a character a linchpin for progression.
Which is a real shame because, so when you have a system like this that you ask every players to use everyone, there's sort of a contract with the player that every character has to be interesting enough to be worth using. And I think outside of one character that I personally just don't like, it really succeeds. Like almost every character has both a mechanical and like aesthetic thing that makes them cool and interesting and that you want to deal with them.
I will definitely give it to the aesthetics of the game. The 11 psychics are all supposed to be from the same organization and therefore ostensibly should have the same uniform. Even with that, the character designers did an amazing job and all of them look great and distinct from each other. I was so impressed when I saw that for the first time.
They all look great and distinct, and with like maybe two exceptions, they all look like they're actually wearing a uniform.
Yeah.
Modified uniforms, but like a uniform. There's a guy who basically just wears like some cool clothes and like a girl whose gimmick is that she likes to be cute and so is like wearing cute backpack and things. So outside of those two, everyone like fits in this uniform aesthetic.
So impressive. Unfortunately, I will say I don't think the characterization lives up to that.
No, and this is like one of the interesting things of the structure is that everyone potentially can be a traitor. Which means that nobody can have a backstory that precludes them from being evil to some extent.
Yeah.
It also means that no conversation from the first area onwards can ever assume that two characters are going to be in the same conversation. So 99% of dialogue after the tutorial section is a thing happens and every character gives their comment on it. And then another thing happens. And if there is conversation, it is usually either like said to the ether and other characters like respond to that. So it could be anyone that's saying it. And there are a few like pre-planned set conversations that can happen later, but not a lot of them.
I will admit, because I didn't get very far in the game, which means that I had to deal with majority of the cast of characters for most of my playtime. It got tiring to enter a new room and then one person would speak and then second person speaks and then I go, oh, I have to listen to all of them say something.
And the great benefit to having your cast slowly die off in this system is those conversations get shorter.
Shorter and shorter.
Which is a big negative. But going back onto like the other thing you said about combat's getting homogenous, I will give it to the game that that is just something inevitable with any system that has high customization. Because in a high customization system, you can never assume players have tools. And this is just a high customization system with less player agency, I guess you can say.
I will mostly agree with you on that. But I will also note that one of the ways to look at it, so if you're ever a designer in the same situation, facing the same problem, right, where there are so many ways to build a character that it becomes somewhat of a challenge for you to design challenges. One of the things to keep in mind is literally just damage floors, because an approach to this is thinking of encounters, fights as DPS checks. And as long as your players have the damage floor, the minimum amount of damage they need to get through, even if their skills are extremely varied, they should be able to make it. So I agree with you that it's one of the things that is very likely to happen. I disagree with you when you say it's an inevitability.
It's inevitability that things can't tailor to specific challenges to things.
You can't have special challenges that work because X character is here. Yeah, that's true.
And we should just like take a minute to outline a little bit of diversity within this cast. Because we've established that they are different, but we haven't said how. So we've got some characters that are pretty basic. There's a healer who does healing. His damage dealing attack is healing over maximum AP even. So you've got stuff like that. You've also got characters that teleport, which means they ignore enemy positioning, go like through them to straight behind rather than having to go around.
Which matters because position matters and you can back attack, which does more damage.
You've got a character who can psychically link with any other character to copy their abilities, and any stat that is higher than theirs, they can match or exceed potentially with later skills. And so, yeah, it's like a small smattering of characters that you've got in the game. And then you've got a bunch of like fairly typical characters, like you've got a character who's, they have a machine gun and AoE effects. You've got a mage who does mage things.
Yeah, there are a number of element characters, fire element character, lightning element character, etc.
So yeah, we've got a variety of characters that all have fairly distinct different abilities that do very different things. So it's likely that you would have picked, if this game didn't have this death mechanic, that you would have picked a set group of six and just stuck with them. But not in here. So there are a few reasons why you've changed party. It's not just the death mechanic itself that causes that. It's also the traitor mechanic. So a large part of the game is playing missions, perhaps a little bit excessively, to at the end of every mission, you get a message that says there are X dissenting voices in your party. Every floor, there are three potential candidates of the traitor that you have a limited resource to check if they are actually the traitor or not. And so we're playing a sort of mastermind style mini game, essentially through the party compositions. You can identify those three potential candidates, use the resource, and find out who is the traitor ideally. Or you might find you've wasted all your points and you don't know who it is for sure, and you have to take just a lucky guess. But regardless, at the end of each floor, someone will be lost, even if they aren't the traitor, which has no real impact until the very, very end of the game, having the traitor in your party. So you didn't resonate super strongly with the actually identifying the traitor part. How did you find that?
Yeah, it was a lot of attempting to get more out of the system than the luck was giving me. So there's a bit of RNG involved with the way you set up your party and the way the dissenting voices fall.
Yeah, so there's three random dissenting voices every floor. And then it's a case of, like, more or less you need to luck into getting a party that has some of them. And if you're unlucky, you can get, like, multiplied as just one voice. And in order to do, like, solutions, you need more data than just one of these six people.
So it was a combination of I'd never really played a mastermind-like game seriously before. I was trying to rush to a solution to get experience in the game, and the party combinations I was trying were not giving me concrete answers. Like, I would get to, like, ah, oh, there's a probably 66% chance that I'm right on a guess, for example. And then by the time I used up my vision points to check, turns out 33% had come through this time, which is, like, very reasonable. Like, a 1 in 3 chance is a 1 in 3 chance, but... yeah, I got a bit unlucky. So I didn't actually find my traitor for the first actual traitor check.
And one of the interesting things is that in the immediate, it's not a huge issue. The big reveal with traitors is not terrible spoilers here, that in the final battle, they will fight against you in the end, which reduces your party. But the game is balanced around the fact that all of your party members could be the traitor. So the final battle is pretty manageable by just the protagonist. So even if you fail to notice the traitor each floor, you still have that forced party diversity. So I guess it still works out in the end.
Yeah, in terms of... tackling dominant strategy or dominant party compositions, it still does what it wants to do. What I'm curious is if you could ignore the mastermind system altogether and just decide from the very beginning, I want to play this party all the way through, regardless of, you know what I mean?
Actually, yeah, now that you've said it, so I've never really thought about trying to do that, because at the end of the game, since the consequences aren't too huge, you don't know that as a player when you play through, but the game doesn't explicitly punish you until the very final battle. So if you're fine with just a slightly challenging end battle, you could gamble on your third party being traitors or not, and just play through, brute force it with who you like, and finish. I think that it'd end up being a kind of unpleasant experience, because the game's balanced around you doing many missions over and over again to get the mastermind stuff to function.
But in theory...
you said it, that's a really interesting point. In theory, yeah, you could ignore this, and the punishment is relatively minimal.
But having said that, the systems are in place for you to change up your party, to get a varied experience, and to not let the game just become any other old RPG.
Thinking of a game that's not any other RPG, I'm going to look at something that is a much more granular sense of forced character builds. Unlimited Saga is a 2002 JRPG by Square Enix Product Division 2, directed, produced, and designed by Akitoshi Kawazu, who has been the steward of the Saga series. Unlimited Saga is, for better and worse, trying to simulate a tabletop RPG sort of experience, which is why I unconfidently said JRPG. And in doing so, it presents players pretty directly with a lot of randomness. Almost every action comes with some chance something unexpected coming up, and this is always presented through a gambling-esque reel. So it's very explicit that a lot of things are random in this game, but even things that aren't as explicit about being random like that can feel random to players. Even aspects of character growth are determined through random factors, like after dungeons, characters obtain skill panels. They put on a character board, basically, that lets them get stronger. That's their main way of getting mechanically more powerful. But you don't know what options you're going to have at the end of a dungeon. You just get presented randomly with about four of these.
It is somewhat influenced by the actions that you did in the dungeon or the things that happened to your character in the dungeon. But yeah, for the most part, it's pretty opaque what you're supposed to get.
They're pretty loosely related. You're influencing the random number generator, but you're not creating definite outcomes. So maybe you fought a lot with swords, but you might get, you know, gun skill level 2 instead of sword skill level 2. You got an attack weapon, but not the one you were using, kind of thing. And so Saga kind of exists in contrast to a lot of role-playing games, kind of like Lost Dimension does, in that in a lot of games, you get characters and you think, ah, I want this character to be a mage.
and Unlimited Saga asks you to put aside those hopes and dreams for a while and ask you to look at what you get given and build characters based on that. So it's sort of a weird halfway between what Shirin and Lost Dimension are doing and taking it in a different direction. You're responding to randomness in how your characters are built, but it's a little bit more subtle, perhaps, than Lost Dimension's approach was.
They're still growing. They're still just getting better. You're just not fully in control.
And in a lot of games, so we have like the random skill panels. In other RPGs, if you had such a system, you would go, oh, if I get a skill panel at the end of every dungeon, I'm just going to replay this dungeon that's fairly easy, like X times, and get the things I want. In Unlimited Saga, it mitigates that by every time you finish a dungeon, it increases the power level of basically everything a little bit. So if you replay dungeons too often, you will probably fall behind the power curve. Alongside this, you have weapon durability, in which when you use weapons, uses up limited slots. But the amount of weapons that you can obtain from shops and things is limited. And at some point, you might run out of things to equip. And you can get by with punches and kicks, but they're not as strong as actual weapons. I haven't got a good source, but according to GameSpot, Kawazu made this game aware that no one would like it, yet he was determined to make it happen anyway. He's a director that's often tried to make interesting things that question how we learn about games, I guess. So his games are about understanding systems, as opposed to seeing a system and working from that point.
So at over 4 minutes into this discussion, it is worth noting that almost everything we've talked about that pertain to the game's mechanics are not explained in the game. They're kind of shown with, like, for example, the random chance thing. You've shown that and you can kind of infer that, but the game is aggressively untutorialized. It doesn't want to hold your hand in any kind of way, and might be the first game that we have ever talked about that is not something that either of us can recommend as a play experience.
As a learning experience, as a study experience, yeah. I think it's a fascinating piece of work. As a, I want to sit down and have some fun for this kind of experience, I think there are many better options. Even within the Saga series.
Yeah, notorious as it is. I would even almost say that this is a very good counterexample of a game to pick up to see how opaque you can make mechanics and like how not interesting that is to players. Because you lose interest very quickly as just a player if you come up against these, oh, it's a seemingly random system and I have no control over it, you know?
And that's sort of where I think this game is interesting in the discussion. Originally, I put this in our list because I thought, oh, it presents randomness very clearly to players and that has a big impact on the feel of the game, which is very true. To the point, though, that the rest of the game being kind of hard to understand stops players knowing what is random and what is not random to a large degree, which is, yeah, really demoralizing for a lot of people because it's a little bit too much in the I don't know what I can influence even.
Here is a concrete example that I only know about because some expert talked about it in another podcast. When you have the random slot reel thing going in an out-of-combat encounter, there's a 50% chance that it stops on the thing you select, and then a 10% chance for the next five things, and that's how it determines where it stops on that reel. That's so arbitrary.
So the only real way to like guarantee success is to find a string of successes on the reel, which like that is more consistency than a real dice would offer you, but it's a weird way to simulate that effect.
It really is. And it's a fascinating design space because in my mind, I immediately think to myself, that's super cool as a concept. Number one, if it was expressed more clearly to the player. And number two, if you could reduce that by mastery, because you can get better at things like lockpicking. You can get better at things like, I don't remember what the one for trap are, but you know, you can get better at those things. And imagine a world where getting better panels for those skills reduced the number of subsequent reel slots that it checks and, you know, puts the percentage into the previous ones or whatever. Like, that's a super interesting design space.
And the skills, the way that skills work, though, is they actually increase the amount of successes on the reel.
Instead of, yeah.
Which increases the amount of successive successes, that is a terrible sentence, on the reel that you can, like, get these strings. But, yeah, the game never says, oh, there's a chance it might fall on a later reel. That's never explained in the game. And the manual does help a little bit, but not for most of these systems. The manual mostly helps for the kind of unintuitive control scheme, to put it nicely.
That's a completely different discussion. But no, the randomness is really cool in the, I want to nut out how this is random. And not that cool in the, this is what it's doing to my gameplay.
Yeah, it's sort of going a little bit overboard with this. I always enjoy having to build characters based on what I find. Like, that's something that's just a deeply, deeply appealing thing, which is why Sheeran and Lost Dimension are both on this list, because I love adapting to those things in kind of short and mid-form RPGs. But Unlimited Saga is a few steps too far in that direction. And I think that might be all we have to say about this, right?
Without, yeah, getting caught up in specifics and stuff.
We could say more, because there's lots of interesting specifics. Absolutely. And edge cases, but moving on to our last game, which brings us down from even a shorter form than things like Sheeran, we're going to look at a fighting game. Guilty Gear Xrd Revelator 2, a 2017 2D fighting game in the esteemed Guilty Gear series by Arc Systems Works, designed by Daisuke Ishiwatari. We're going to specifically look at one character in this and a few similar characters from other Arxis fighting games. The item character is the archetype, and in Guilty Gear, this character is Faust. The item character in a fighting game is the character that can conjure items in a generally random way onto the battlefield.
At least varied way. If not truly random, yeah.
Yes, some games have it not quite truly random, but in Faust's case, it's truly random. And not all these items are good, some are quite bad, and a lot affect both players equally. And these characters generally are valuing improvisation. You make a random situation occur, and it's about what do you do in response. Obviously, the player who plays this character will know better what to do with each situation, but it's up to both players to recognize what's going on and to act on it. Some of the cool things about Faust specifically are that when you use an item command, you can hold it for longer, which is good for spacing certain moves. And it also just gives you a chance to like work out what you are actually going to be doing. But the longer you hold it, of course, the more opportunity your opponent has to work out what they should do about it, which I think is an interesting little like double-sided nuance, which is key to a lot of these sorts of characters' movesets, that they affect both players quite often.
Now, the question becomes, why make something unreliable? And the simple answer is that when you do it this way, first of all, it's more fun, right? Variance, variety.
It's more fun in the air quotes fun.
Yeah, definitely. I didn't know if I could convey that very well. But it also means that you can put overtuned effects on it. You can have some things that are very powerful, but because they're not consistent, they may be all right.
And Arxis games do deal a little bit with inconsistent moves. So there's a character in Guilty Gear as well, Chip, who can fire shurikens. And there's a set order to which shurikens will be useful and which will be bad. And that's a very set, like, two bad ones and then one good one or something. And his play revolves around wasting the bad usage in safe ways. Whereas Faust has purely random, you can never guarantee that, oh, now I'm going to get a good thing, unlike him.
So it becomes a statistical thing, I feel like. You want to be able to throw out enough items that you get a good one eventually, and you're just trying to deal with the bad ones or the less favorable ones in at least a neutral condition so that you don't lose position, you don't gain position, but yeah.
And in fighting games, there's always an opportunity cost. I mean, in most games, there's always an opportunity cost. But in fighting games, often the moments in which you are safe could have been doing something that's a better guarantee. And Guilty Gear has a large emphasis on Oki, which is the process of like waking up off the background after you've been knocked down. So Faust players are often choosing to sacrifice a good wake-up situation against their opponent for the opportunity to get a good item, hopefully, that will let them alter the battlefield in a more dramatic way than that wake-up situation could have been. That's the gamble that Faust is playing.
Sometimes that good item is the Oki you're talking about, and sometimes it leads to unavoidable situations. So
a lot of the time, they really drastically play up how players will act for the next few seconds. Yeah. Like, a good, pretty intuitively easy example is a bomb. One of the items Faust can get at fairly low chance is a bomb that affects both players equally with a large explosion that is pretty damaging. It is affected by, like, punches and kicks, I believe.
So it can be moved around the battlefield, and you get to just watch the fuse tick down as you try to deal with not being in the space.
And everyone is, like, clear what's going on. It's visually intuitive how it works, which is very important for these sorts of things. And it really changes up for just a few moments how everyone plays. And how the bomb situation plays out is very different to, say, the black hole item, in which players are drawn to a single spot and can't really escape it. So it forces extremely close quarters, which obviously different characters are differently good at and things, and Faust isn't especially good at ridiculously close quarters since he's a fairly slow character. So yeah, each move presents fairly different situations for characters to be in and requires everyone to adapt really quickly about it. And Faust is particularly interesting for item characters in that his items affect the play field more than just his character, I guess. So for looking at other arcs as item characters, looking, I guess, one franchise earlier, we've got the Persona 4 Arena game with Teddy. Teddy's very different to Faust in that while he uses the same kinds of items, in that they are often small little things that come onto the battlefield, a lot of Teddy's items don't affect both players equally. A lot of offensive items only affect the opponent. And Teddy's items are on a set rotation. There are like 20 or 30 different items he can drop, and they always occur in the same order, and there are ones you want to get through. So much like Chip, you're trying to burn the bad items out to get to the good things. So it's about managing time.
And with Teddy, some of his items can lock down the opponent for enough time that even if he doesn't get a hit off of them, he can use that time to burn out more to get to the next good one again.
Yes. Teddy is a character that's playing with time almost more than the items themselves, really, to get to his good item. So any item that burns more time is incredibly useful to him.
And this definitely stems from the fact that his items are asymmetrical, where Faust's aren't. Faust has to react to bad things that can happen to him from his own ability. Teddy can mostly just throw out items with impunity, so long as he has space to do so.
Yeah, there are a few items that, like, the first player to touch it heals and things, which are technically bad if the other player gets them, but they're usually not of dramatic consequence.
And so Teddy is a lot more consistent than Faust, but his items themselves don't have that huge power spike.
Yeah, like, his most powerful items are very good, but they're not. But the bomb deals a ridiculous amount of damage in relation to the overall HP. Like, getting one bomb to hit successfully is worth more than a decent combo.
And where Faust has potential to unblockable setups and stuff like that, as we said, Teddy's are locked down, so it gives you the opportunity for the setup, not necessarily the damage guaranteed.
And ideally, like, you can use your setups to end up getting to hit your combo, which is where your damage really comes from, but the items themselves are not the source of the damage. So Teddy's allowed to be more consistent because none of his effects are so over the top. And then the next character in this item character sort of setup would be Platinum the Trinity, the magical girl character from Blayblue. And she's very different in that she has no bad items, she has no equal effect items, so each one of her items is basically giving her a different special move for a limited amount of usages that are all weapons that she uses. And when you press the button to trigger them, you can see what the next one's going to be at any point. So, like, I know currently I have the missiles, and I can see the next item will be the bombs, as a random example. And so you know what's coming, but you don't know what the next thing might be. So Platinum, compared to the other characters, has a much better idea of what her game plan can be, but she doesn't know the long-term game plan, unlike most normal fighting game characters. And all her items are ostensibly good. There's very little that is, oh, I don't want this item, so I want to, like, just burn through it as quickly as possible. There's more, this is not the best situation for this item, but I'll find a way to make it work.
Yep. They can always apply pressure. They can always take up screen real estate, which is a very important thing in fighting games. The less room your opponent has to operate in, the better like your position is in the game.
Yeah. So those are the three sort of item-using characters, and each of them are influencing the battlefield in a random way. Well, except for Teddy. And how each of these like impact their consistency is very interesting and different. Like Platinum is consistent. All her things are going to be useful and good, but it's more about how you apply them. Faust is more like responding to a lot of very different stimuli. And Teddy is less about the randomness and more getting to the points you need to and dealing with stuff between those points.
And especially in the cases of Faust and Teddy, it is very much worth noting that if they had consistent access to their good moves, they would be far too good.
Yes.
They would, in the case of Faust, he would just run away, be the best character ever if he could consistently do his best moves.
Yes, like if Faust could just pick, oh, I want to use this move now, he'd be a dramatically different character.
Yeah.
And nowhere near as interesting. And actually, it's not quite the same, but in the game Blay Blue Cross Tag Battle, Platinum, the Trinity, is a very different character in that she just has all her items as special moves.
Yeah.
They're all toned down,
mm-hmm.
but they're all there. And not only is she, well, she's not particularly good in that game, but she's much less interesting because of that lack of adaptability. Because her moveset was never really built to be standalone and consistent. It was mm-hmm. built to like deal with lots of interesting situations that you couldn't quite predict.
She could occasionally have a very good answer for a specific situation or a mediocre answer for... Mm. But if you use that same answer in another one, it's just mediocre and you know, things like that.
Yeah, so if Faust could just use all these special moves, they would probably be toned down to a degree that makes them kind of uninteresting. Or he would be absurdly broken.
And the fact that he can be absurdly broken, like, that's worth it, right? Like, for one out of maybe a quarter of every game, Faust is just monstrous and hard to stop. That's interesting.
And we've probably mentioned this in another episode somewhere, but whenever you can make someone play your game, that is a strong moment. When as opposed to playing their game, they're playing in yours. And Faust makes both players have to respond to the random number generator much more so than most characters do. And that is something that is great fun about him. I know some players don't always appreciate that level of randomness, but when it's isolated to a specific character and a few variables that both players respond to at fairly similar timings, I think that benefits a lot.
I think that's about it. That's about all we have to say, which means that it's about time for closing notes. Alright, so in this episode, we talked about consistency mitigation, how you can have very powerful things in your game, in your core loop, in your experience, and that might be fine because as long as the players can't abuse it because it's not consistent, then you'll still get a varied play experience. The first thing we talked about was Magic the Gathering in the physical sense of the card game. The fact that you have a deck of either 40 to 60 cards as a minimum, and that you can only have a maximum of 4 copies of one card, particularly powerful cards won't be that likely, even if you can draw them. Following that, we talked about Shirin the Wanderer, where it's a roguelike, and Shirin himself is a very, very simple character, and there's not much to his toolkit. But he has to deal with a lot of different kinds of items in an unreliable fashion. The way he gets them, the order he gets them, changes the kind of run that you're going to get, even if some of these items are going to be very powerful.
And Lost Dimension takes us into a more long-form play experience and trying to deal with the classic issue that RPGs have of sticking with only one party and not varying up your characters, and really builds mechanics around forcing you to change up your team pretty frequently. Unlimited Saga goes maybe the extra mile, as some might say, in dealing with consistency mitigation and resulting in a system that is hard or difficult to read, but really asking players to respond to somewhat random character growth and making plans around what comes to them. And lastly, we looked at Guilty Gear Xrd Rev 2, focusing on Faust and other Arxis item characters and how in very short form, real time situations, random items can affect how players react and adapt situations. And with that, we thank you for being consistent in your listening through this episode and that you did not mitigate that consistent habit. If you want to talk to us about other games you thought would be interesting on this topic, you can find us on social media and through our email and our website, all in the show notes. And next month, our hints for what we're going to talk about are Bravely Default, Red Alert 3, and Devil May Cry 4. And with that,
thanks for listening.